Welcome to another edition of Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Dan Tsang with Subversity. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. With us today is a graduate student from Hong Kong, a UCI graduate student, Choy Wai Kit, and he was an eyewitness to some momentous events in Hong Kong in December. Welcome, Wai Kit.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for coming in so early.
You're very welcome.
You happen to be in Hong Kong doing research.
Was actually in both Hong Kong and Shanghai in the last 6 months. I spent more time in Hong Kong than Shanghai for my own research. And I was in Hong Kong in December, and even before actually the protesters went to Hong Kong, or even before the WTO meeting actually began, there were already a lot of reports and anticipations of the protesters in Hong Kong, because people there really worry about the disruption of social order and how the everyday life is going to be interrupted by the anti-WTO demonstrations.
It seems like a kind of almost a moral panic. I mean, or some kind of panic, because the papers were saying they would have to have hospital beds for hundreds of or thousands of people that would be injured.
Yeah.
I was staying in Hong Kong at the beginning of the protests, and even the hotel I was in, which was also in Wan Chai, which is where the protests were, they boarded up the front door with wood, and all the stores on the storefronts in the same block had wooden panels. There was an antique store, and they were worried that these antiques would get broken again.
Yeah.
So it seemed kind of overreaction in retrospect.
Yeah, in some ways kind of interesting, because the fear of the demonstration that existed before the WTO conference was a result of media hype in a lot of ways, because the local Chinese newspapers and TV stations, they kept on reporting about what WTO protesters did in Seattle, for instance, and in Mexico. And there's also a widespread report of this one South Korean peasant leader who committed suicide in one of the WTO demonstrations. I think that's back in 2003 or 2004. I don't really remember. I think it's Cocoon. So that's why people were really expecting a lot of violence and direct action on the part of the protesters.
But there were local people protesting too, right? Not just people from outside Hong Kong.
Yes, definitely. There was maybe just like some background to the WTO conference itself and why it took place in Hong Kong. Now, basically what happened after 1997, there's the year of the Asian financial crisis. There is an economic downturn in Hong Kong. And what was also interesting was that 1997 was the year that Hong Kong returned to mainland China. Then what happened since then is that the newly, not elected, but the new governor, the new government of Hong Kong, has been trying hard to rescue Hong Kong's economy. Now, one of the things he's trying to do is to kind of create or to strengthen the image of Hong Kong as a global city so that they can attract more multinational corporations to set up the regional headquarters there. And one of the ways to do this is to host a WTO conference in Hong Kong so as to, get the name Hong Kong out there to the wider international community.
Yeah, they call in the ads, they call Hong Kong the international city, right?
Yeah. Asia's world city. That's like the official slogan.
World city.
And so that's one of the major reasons why the Hong Kong government decided to host the WTO meeting there. Now, then at the same time, like, because as in all WTO meetings, they all know that there's going to be a lot of demonstrations. So this explains all these reactions and nervous anticipations of what is going to happen in Hong Kong. Now, what is interesting is after the protesters arrived in Hong Kong, especially the South Korean protesters, there's a, I guess, dramatic change in the media's treatment of the anti-WTO demonstrators. Now, what happened was that, I guess, the South Korean protesters really tried hard to reach out to the Hong Kong people after they arrived. They also knew about the media hype and, I guess, stereotype of South Korean protesters as really violent and, you know, prone to action during demonstrations. And this, in some way, what is interesting is toward the end of the WTO conference, there is actually somewhat widespread support on the part of Hong Kong people for the South Korean protesters.
After they arrived.
After they arrived, yeah. Now, but what's really important to point out is that the South Korean protesters was the largest group in the demonstration. But there were also many other demonstrators from other parts of Asia. Now, the WTO meeting started on Tuesday, I think, December. I don't remember the exact date. But and then, yeah.
I think the initial march was on Sunday, right?
Yeah, exactly. The initial march was on Sunday. Now, what's interesting about that march was that you see a lot more diversity in that groups in the sense that there isn't really, like, any one national group dominating the demonstration. Now, on Sunday, that day, there's a lot of NGOs from the Philippines, from Indonesia. There are also a lot of female migrant laborers who were working in Hong Kong. They participated in the demonstration that day.
Yeah, I was there on Sunday. I happened to be still being in Hong Kong, and it seemed to be very joyous. There was music, there was chanting, but there was also, I mean, there was celebratory, I would say, in some ways.
Yeah.
At the beginning, when they started.
Yeah.
And there were all these groups you said from Indonesia, from South Asia, different groups.
Yeah.
And did you find that, was there any representation from U.S. at all? Did you find, there was some? Small groups?
I think I came across some small groups from the U.S. I think student groups, actually.
Right.
The
day before, I ran to a former UCI student
who
was with a group from the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. And they had flown, maybe 10 of them had flown out to Hong Kong.
Actually, I think the Garment Workers Center is a NGO based in L.A. And it's a group that specializes in... Garment workers issues.
Yeah.
I think they were there, actually, representatives from that group.
Also in Hong Kong. I think Global Exchange sent some delegation, I believe, the San Francisco group.
Yeah.
Did you find that? How did the protests? The police deal with the protesters that day, that Sunday?
I was there, but I didn't really. Follow the procession all the way from Victoria Park to the government building in Central, the government office in Central. So I wasn't there the whole time, but the time when I was there, I think, again, what is... I guess to understand the police reaction, again, has to understand the logic of Hong Kong's, I guess, economic policy. Now, because, like I was saying earlier, the Hong Kong government is really concerned with building up Hong Kong as... what they call Asia's world city, meaning it's a place that would take in multinational corporations and foreign capitals, hoping that they would set up their regional headquarters there. And Hong Kong government is really concerned with bringing in tourists from all over the world into Hong Kong. Now, what has happened to the Hong Kong police force is that, and this is not just Hong Kong police force, but to probably the entire Hong Kong civil government structure, was the government trying to turn it into a business-like organization, meaning they are trying to promote this kind of like customers always right mentality. Yeah. And so in a way, what they have turned the Hong Kong police force into when dealing with especially Westerners is to kind of like turn them into... like a semi-tourist agency. That is, they need to be really polite to foreigners or people, you know, who are not from Hong Kong. I'm talking more mostly like about, you know, in the treatment of Westerners.
Not people from China.
No, people from Southeast Asia probably. So now what happened is that that day, there were also a lot of Western media there, right? So the Hong Kong police really had to show them that they're, you know, they're civilized and they respect law, international decorum.
Right. And so we're going to play a I want to play a clip of the first day of the protests and of this was first day on a Sunday, I think December 1st or December 2nd, something like that. In the early December in Hong Kong. And we'll see. Hopefully, this is a little experiment here. We're playing it off a camcorder, but you can't see the image. But hopefully, you can hear some of the sound, and we'll see if this works. This was a march that started from, like Waikid said, Victoria Park. And this is all in Wan Chai District, and then it goes on to Central. And so this was at the beginning of at the middle at the early part of the march, and let's see if we can hear this. That was a Hong Kong legislator, Thong Hae, who is a radical that was elected to a Hong Kong government governing legislative council. And he was walking along with next to some statues of emaciated people from Africa, it looks like, of starving people, basically.
Yeah.
He was speaking in English, which was a surprise.
Yeah,
he was trying to get the audience or the bystanders to join in.
Yeah, Long Hair is actually a pretty interesting character in the Hong Kong political landscape, and he has somewhat of a international reputation, I guess. Now, what is characteristic of him or what he is known for is he's always wearing a Che Guevara T-shirt every time he goes to demonstration, and also he was a member of a Trotskyite group based in Hong Kong.
April 15?
Well,
April,
that's whatever. Actually... I'm talking about like a previous group affiliated with.
Yeah.
Now, April 5th is something that I think he was a founding member of.
Right.
Now, so in some way, the fact that he got elected into the Legislative Council in Hong Kong... as someone who publicly talked about his socialist ideals, is kind of unusual given the politically conservative environment in Hong Kong.
I did ask him a few things, and maybe we can play a little bit of that. Let's see if we can hear it. Yeah. Oh, I was talking about, I was telling him that there was a public opinion conference in Hong Kong, and they issued a report during the conference that they interviewed people from different countries about their attitude towards the protests, and the Hong Kong people were against it. This is before the protests, and this is from a Hong Kong U World Public Opinion Conference. But people in other countries were of different opinions.
Uh,
So here's... So what's he saying now? Can you hear?
A little bit, yeah. But I think he was saying something about international finance and how certain financial practices are not ethical. Yeah. Well, he's talking about how people in Hong Kong, they politically apathetic and they care more about making money. But I think what's interesting about this long hair, this person named Long Hair, actually is not him per se. It's more, I think, has to do with the fact that he even got elected, how there's actually a, public reception for that kind of quasi or semi-leftist ideas. Now, I guess there are many different reasons why the anti-WTO demonstration in Hong Kong was interesting. Now, we can first leave aside Hong Kong. And in some way, many people I know are not very interested in Hong Kong, per se. It's
right.
A small city, you know, somewhere over there in Asia. A lot of people don't even know where Hong Kong is, or maybe just they think it's part of China. Now, but in the...
It is part of China now, I guess.
It is part of China now, yeah. But, like, in a... world of real politics between China and U.S., Taiwan is a major issue. And there's a strong link between what's going on in Hong Kong and in Taiwan, because the political arrangement between Hong Kong and China is referred to as one country, two systems. And supposedly there's a model that the mainland Chinese government is going to use for the relationship between Taiwan and mainland China. So a lot of people think whether there's political stability in Hong Kong or whether there's going to be economic recovery or stability will kind of prove whether the mainland Chinese agenda for Taiwan will work too.
So Hong Kong is like the test case. About integration, you know, they want to integrate Taiwan, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like from the mainland Chinese perspective,
right.
Now, but at the same time, there's a lot of local demand for direct election, because right now in Hong Kong, there's not yet direct election. The governor of Hong Kong, or the, what they call the chief executive, was actually elected by a committee composed of 800 people. So the chief executive in Hong Kong is not directly elected by the people of Hong Kong.
And those that committee is handpicked by people by China, right?
At the end, you can say it's handpicked by China, but not immediately.
Not immediately,
because there's some like mechanism to make semi-election within small groups, right? So basically, there are some mechanisms that you can't really say is immediately handpicked by the Chinese government, but somehow the mechanisms that can filter out oppositional voices.
Mm.
Now, but what is interesting is that Western powers, U.S. and Britain, are definitely involved in bringing, say, direct election to Hong Kong. A lot of people, well, not people, a lot of quote-unquote Democrats actually have ties to the conservative factions
in
the U.S.
Like
the Heritage Foundation.
Like Martin Lee.
Exactly. Yeah. So what is interesting about WTO and someone like Long Hair is traditionally you hear like dissidents or oppositional voices to mainland China, or people who kind of stand up and challenge, the mainstream, public political order. Now, what you saw in the anti-WTO demonstration, and there's also actually organizations like local Hong Kong, quote-unquote, Maoist group, like people who identify themselves with Maoist socialism, now who were also at the anti-WTO demonstrations. The point was that you're beginning, at least I saw, alternatives or like organizations that try to come up with a alternative political vision to the one that's been offered by the mainstream middle class, quote unquote, Democrats that have been supported by Western powers. I think from a local standpoint, the anti-WTO demonstration was interesting for that reason.
But also the alliance, there was a People's Alliance against the WTO, a locally organized group that that worked with the Koreans. And I remember reading after the protests that the leader of that group, she was writing and saying that Hong Kong people, Hong Kong activists can learn from the Koreans for their discipline, basically, because they would march and demonstrate and then go back and have meetings until late at night and, you know, plan next day's activities. And the Hong Kong people, she said, could learn from this discipline kind of practice.
Yeah, and I think this is why the anti-WTO demonstration was also interesting, not necessarily from a Hong Kong standpoint, but from a more global standpoint. And there are two things that are interesting about that. Now, first, just like Dan was saying earlier, it's the South Korean demonstrators. Now, at the beginning of the show, we were saying how there's a media hype about how the South Korean protesters are going to go to Hong Kong, they're going to like create chaos, and there's going to be a lot of violence, right? So basically, the Hong Kong public, they were afraid of the South Korean protesters before they went there. Now, but what happened was that after they got there, now, they really, really impressed the people there. Now, the first thing they did, well, I guess among the many different things they did was they clean up after themselves. Every time after they went to the demonstration, they pick up all the trash, you know, and they try to, like, and they would say apologize to the Hong Kong people via the reporters saying, you know, we're sorry, you know, we're here, we have to do this, but, you know, we're not trying to trash Hong Kong. So they try to do, like, little things that to express their sensitivity to, like, Hong Kong public's perception of them. So
to try to change it.
Pardon me?
Okay, to change the perception.
Yeah. And also another thing they did was they really show, kind of like what Dan was saying earlier, how the Hong Kong activists can learn from South Korean protesters. They show organizational skills and logistical planning. Now, the second day, so the first protest was on Sunday, and that was before most of the South Korean protesters arrived in Hong Kong. Now, Tuesday, that's the day when the WTO meeting began. Now, that one demonstration was pretty much dominated by the South Korean protesters. There are many different organizations from South Korea who were there. One of the peasant organizations is called Korean Peasant League, KPL. And it was one of the more radical organizations that was there. And what happened was that the WTO meeting was in a building called Wan Chai Convention Center. Now, the Hong Kong police basically blocked off the road to the convention center.
Access roads.
And that there's a designated demonstration area is right by the pier. So all the protesters, they had to go to designated protest area.
And they had these barriers, right? They were filled with water or something. There were plastic barriers with water in it, I thought.
It was right by the pier, actually. Yeah. So,
and they put barriers in front of the convention center, so you couldn't go there.
So there are barriers in front of the convention center. Now, so what happened was that on Tuesday, the first day of the WTO meeting, the Korean protesters separated themselves into different groups. So one group jumped into the pier. Now, remember, this December, and then they tried to swim to the convention center, and then that distracted, you know, the police, right? Uh-huh. Now, at the same time, another group of Korean protesters, they marched up to the police line, and they're trying to break the police line, and then fightings erupted, and police used pepper spray on them. And then, so that one group of Korean protesters retreated. And then there was another group of Korean protesters who marched up and tried to break a police line. So what happened that day was, and then the reporters wrote about it, and I was there, and people the next day read about the organizational skills of these protesters. They're not just some random violent individuals who's trying to, you know, destroy everything in sight.
Not some crazies. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're not some crazies. They're just planning. Now, and then they did not have demonstration every day, right? So we just mentioned two demonstrations. One was on Sunday, and then another one on Tuesday. Now, in between, because the WTO meeting lasted for at least a week, right?
Yeah.
These protesters separated themselves into small groups, a group of maybe 10 people, 12 people.
Yeah.
And then they would take the Hong Kong subway, or they would take like buses, and then they tried to pass up leaflets to Hong Kong people wherever they saw them. And they were chanting on the street, and they went to different parts of Hong Kong. They would go into a restaurant. They would talk to people in the restaurant. They try to talk to them about WTO. So there's all these kind of community outreach. Now, and then there is another protest. It's kind of interesting because they embody a Buddhist practice into that one protest. There's a protest where they would take three steps, and then all these protesters, they would bow with their forehead touching the ground, touching the street.
Wow.
And then they would get up again, three steps, and then they bow again. And then it took them about an hour and a half to finish that march, or maybe even 2 hours.
These are Koreans?
Yeah, these are all South Korean protests. Now, the purpose of that protest is to show their commitment to the cause.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know how that kind of protest, what kind of reaction it would get if they were doing it in the U.S. Now, but in Hong Kong, people probably like, were not really clear what they were doing now. But in Hong Kong, all the onlookers were very moved. Because I thought I think the bowing, you know, with the forehead touching the street is something that they know is something, you do it only in a very, very serious situation, right? To express your sin or, to show, you know, the gravity of the situation, right? Now, so that one demonstration again kind of like made the, I guess, people in Hong Kong realize, hey, you know, they are not just about destruction. They're not here to just, you know, destroy everything, right? They are here for a reason, there's a purpose, and they're committed. And it's, you know, it's a good, in some way, from a strategic standpoint, it's good. Yeah.
So it was impressive. I mean, it impressed people about their motivation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, yeah.
Do you think their message about explaining the WTO went out also? At first, I think from the polling, it seemed like people didn't really know what the WTO did or had done, or what GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, had done as a predecessor group. And so there was not much information about that.
Now, this is kind of interesting. I guess, okay, now just going, before I answer that question, I just want to point out what is interesting about, again, the more general point that we can abstract out of the Korean protesters' strategy. We're seeing how before they went to Hong Kong, there was this fear of radical actions, right? And in general, people in Hong Kong, when they have a demonstration, they don't do anything radical. They just, you know, march and then they go home, right?
Or petition, or leave a petition.
They leave a petition, right. Yeah. They would never think of trying to cross a police line. Well, I'm just making generalization.
Generally,
of course,
yeah.
There's like, you know, some exceptional cases sometimes. Now, what is interesting about the Korean strategies in Hong Kong was that I think they created a precondition for radical action. So on Saturday, there's in the same week, right? That's when things got kind of bad. The police used tear gas, mortar cannon, street fightings erupted in different parts of Hong Kong, pepper spray and all that. So that's like when things got a little bit, well, not a little bit, but more radical, right? But regardless, even after that, I think the newspapers in Hong Kong, they did a survey. And then there are at least half of the Hong Kong people who interviewed by the reporters, they still said they understood, you know, what the why the Koreans had to do what they did.
That's now, amazing.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's kind of interesting, the lessons, I guess, for me that I can get out of this event is how every time an activist, when they think of, okay, now what should I do next, you know, and then there's always debate about, oh, are we being too radical? Maybe we shouldn't do this because they're scared the general public, right? They'll scare our supporters away. Now, but maybe another way to think about the issue is to think, if radical action is really indeed necessary, how can we create a precondition so that the general public would accept more radical action? And the Korean did that when they were in Hong Kong.
Yeah, for sure. We're talking with Choy Wai Git, who's a graduate student here at UCI in sociology. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI with Dan Zhang, and the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI itself. So the protests, did it end on Saturday or
in continued? No, actually, no. Yeah. There's another. So what happened on Saturday was, like I was saying, things got a little, well, got more radical. And the protester tried to break a police line. And then the police used tear gas on them. And then the protesters retreated. There were a lot of onlookers, actually. And then onlookers went home after they were tear gassed because too much a price to pay for to be onlooker, that kind of situation.
Yeah.
But the hardcore protesters, they stayed and they took over a street that is near the convention center. And there were about 900 to 1,000 protesters who stayed. And I was among them, actually. Now, what happened is that they just kind of like sat down, took over the street, and all the traffic was closed off, and they were surrounded by riot police. There are two columns of riot police at first, one in front of them and one behind them. And then I left the protesters at one point, and then I went back to join them. It was too late. There are two more police lines. Actually, no, three more police lines.
You can get back in.
I could not get back in. And so I was kind of like outside those protesters. Now, what happened was that there was a standoff there until 5 in the morning on Sunday. And the police decided to simply arrest everybody who was there. And so they were taken to the police station. But then the police gradually released the majority of these protesters. And at the same time, on Sunday, there was another demonstration to support these protesters who were arrested by the Hong Kong police, and that was the last demonstration. Now, what is interesting about that Hong Kong, the Hong Kong police action was that they arrested the majority of these, they released a majority of these protesters, and they ended up bringing charges against 14 of these protesters.
South Koreans, and most of them are South
Chinese. Well, there's a mainland Chinese, right, and a couple Taiwanese protesters there too.
But eventually, I think out of the 900 people that were arrested, basically only like three people still remain to face charges right now. At least that's what I've been reading on the People's Alliance website.
Yeah.
So that's, to me, is amazing. That I think it's partly because Hong Kong government decided they don't want, you know, to drag this on, and you know, because it would be bad for the image. I think the South Korean government officials came to Hong Kong.
Oh yeah, I think the vice foreign minister went to Hong Kong to talk to the Hong Kong government about the protesters.
And
yeah,
most of those South Koreans were actually released.
Yeah, yeah. And then again, like I was saying earlier, like from a standpoint of like say Hong Kong political action, right?
Image for Hong Kong too. They wanted to make it like this international city, not.
Yeah.
They wanted to show they were in control, but they didn't want to show that they were repressive, I guess.
Yeah. And then, so just when all these demonstrations, all these activities were going on, there are also talks among Hong Kong activists saying what they can learn from the Korean protesters. So now what is interesting, again, I guess two general points from just my own observations of the events that week. First is how the protesters were able to create a precondition or create a public opinion that would support direct action. Mm-hmm. Now, and the second thing that I think is interesting is the globalization of resistance strategies. How, as a result of, you know, seeing all these different ways of demonstrating, people in Hong Kong and activists there, they think they can learn a few things from the Koreans.
They can apply.
And in some way, I also there are also many different cases of international solidarity. How, like, you know, Hong Kong onlookers. Actually, it's hard to tell, like, during demonstration, who was an onlooker, who was a participant. People who probably didn't, like, go to the meeting point shop at 2 o'clock, right? But they might nonetheless be a participant. There are times when, like I was saying earlier, how I got locked out of the group of protesters, right, who took over the street that day, right? And then there are also Korean protesters who got locked out, right? And then there are some kind of like pushing and shuffling between Korean protesters who try to get back with the group and Hong Kong police to try to stop them, right? Now, what is interesting is that all these local onlookers, Hong Kong onlookers, the majority of them, the ones I saw, side of the Koreans who kind of harassed, who were saying to the police, just let him go through, you know, shouldn't do this. And then when the Korean protesters try to break a police line, the Hong Kong onlookers actually join in, you know. And I talk to these onlookers, they're not activists. They're not academics. They're people. They work in a hotel. They work there. There's one guy's a chef at a Chinese restaurant, you know. The different kinds of people who've been reading the news, who've been watching the demonstrations, and they became, in a way, I guess, quote-unquote, radicalized.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So do you think people, I mean, in terms of the issues, do you think people realize that that conditions like globalization could affect people in Hong Kong?
There's actually, now, definitely globalization was affecting Hong Kong.
Right.
Now, one of the ways in which globalization affects many different countries is through like IMF and World Bank's policy, right? On how like the government, different governments in different states could cut spending on welfare, they have to reorganize their governmental structure, cut social, you know, cut medical care, you know, and all that, right? Now, what is interesting in Hong Kong since 1997 at least, is there's a similar process going on. The Hong Kong government has been cutting money, subsidies to public housing and all that, right? Now, again, because of probably has a lot to do with the immediate cause, has to do with the 1997 Asian financial crisis, right?
Yeah.
Now, so which means my point then is that definitely you can see in Hong Kong the impacts of globalization and how it has affected everyday life of the workers there. Now, it is a different question as to whether people make a conscious link between their experience and globalization. Now, what is good about having the demonstrations there is that it kind of opened up debates, and there are more people saying, look it, you know, what we're experiencing here also has to do with globalization. It also have, you know, it's just like what the South Koreans are experiencing in South Korea in a way, right?
Right.
So people, I think, making connections as a result of the demonstrations there.
How about this? How about in terms of China, right? I mean, China, did China join the WTO yet?
Yeah.
And so are they relating it? I mean, I guess my general question is, when people, you're saying that these protesters created a space for local people to be more, take more direct action. And then you said that what was interesting about Long Hair's election to the legislature was that somebody who was on the left was able to get into this this spot. Maybe you could talk more about what the left means in Hong Kong. I mean, traditionally the left under the British meant pro-China, right? Has that shifted?
That's an interesting question. Now, first of all, let me be, this is my opinion about Long Hair. Long Hair is someone who presents himself as a leftist and got elected.
Now whether
he is really a leftist, whether he is still a member of any Trotskyite organization, I do not know. Now, but still, now what is interesting is not the, you know, whether he's really leftist or not. What is interesting is how the public actually are not so scared of any association with left-wing politics anymore, in a way.
Right.
Now, going back to the question about the meaning of the left in a Hong Kong or Chinese context, right? Now, let me, maybe I'll just answer that question by way of an example. There was a, like I was saying earlier, a small group of protesters who were carrying red flags saying to what, establish dictatorship of the proletariat in Chinese. And what's the other slogan? I don't exactly remember the other slogan. Now, but they're also carrying portraits of Lenin, Marx, and Mao. Now, that group of protesters attracted a lot of media attention. There are reporters from Washington Post asking them questions, local English newspapers, the Hong Kong Standard, and even the official Chinese news agency, the News China Agency, I think, that's the official mainland Chinese news agency, also interviewed these people because they thought it's really funny because you have Hong Kong people who try to like present a Maoist or leftist politics, right? Now, again, whether these people are really leftist, whatnot, I do not know, okay? But again, I'm just talking about their presentation, right? Now, but still, the presentation means a lot in a way. Again, it, I think it's an indicator of, like, perhaps what people have been thinking as a result of maybe all these financial or economic reforms that the government in Hong Kong has undertaken, right? It's a reaction to that kind of rollback of the kind of welfare policy that they used to have. And as a result, they might shift toward more left-wing politics. Whether it is really left-wing politics in substance, again, I don't know.
I mean, there's still a Mao store in Hong Kong that sells Maoist literature or leftist literature, but there's a picture of Chairman Mao in the window and in the doorway at Causeway Bay, right next to the shopping center.
I know that books are talking about. But now, again, in some way, the whole Mao is sort of becoming a chase symbol these days. So, to what extent, whether people understand or really adhere to Maoism is unclear, and whether it's desirable to bring back that kind of politics is again is another question. I don't know right now, but there are actually many Maoist websites, new Maoist websites in mainland China. Who, and also the group that I just referred to, the Hong Kong group, also has their own website. Now, they also have their own critiques of what is going on in China.
In China, yeah.
And also, you know, so definitely there's an attempt to try to carve out a third role. A third role meaning between, you know, supporting the middle class, quote unquote, Democrats who collaborate with the Project for New American Century. And on the other hand, you have a, you know, Chinese Communist Party who are committed to bringing market reform, or who have been doing it in the last 20 years, you know, to China, right? So definitely there are attempts to carve out a third road in both, I guess, mainland China and Hong Kong.
So do you think, there is still a space in Hong Kong for these voices to flourish? Because people were always saying that, you know, that after China took back Hong Kong, there would be crackdowns on what you can say and what you can do. But what's your opinion on that?
I think to answer that question, I guess, again, it has to do with the contradiction of capitalist development. And it has a lot to do with the particular developmental strategy that the Hong Kong government is adopting. Now, this has to do with the strategy of turning Hong Kong or to maintain Hong Kong's status as a global city. Now, by definition, then you can't really crack down free speech, right? So in a way, that kind of developmental strategy provides room for resistance against
the state
or even capitalism, right? So that's a contradiction.
Because Hong Kong always likes, I know there was a debate in Singapore, Singapore is known as this place where they do crack down on free speech. And I think there was a university in England that was going to set up a research institute there last year and decided not to because they didn't want the academics subject to that kind of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Hong Kong always tries to present itself as an alternative to Singapore.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
being more amenable to Western interests, I guess.
Yeah,
in some way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So do you think that China did invite Long Hair and other people back to China and let them go in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was a bit surprised at that. Is that part of a similar strategy to try to?
The thing is. I guess the people that the mainland Chinese government consider a threat in Hong Kong is not someone like Long Hair. It's more the middle class politicians that I was referring to earlier, people who actually collaborate with the Heritage Foundation or Project for New American Century that kind of politics. So, he's one of the elected officials in the legislative council. So he's invited as part of the package. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, Chinese government's more friendlier to him because, they look at him as a fellow, quote-unquote, socialist. So
I think China is also kind of worried about NGOs, right? I mean the groups you mentioned are also kind of NGOs, I suppose, that are active in civil society kind of development around the world, spreading so-called democracy around the world. And the irony, of course, is if you look at what just happened in Palestine, you can have elections, but people might, get elected that you don't like.
Yeah.
And so do you see that as an inexorable thing happening, that this civil society development, with these Western, so-called Western values of elections, free speech, all of that stuff? Because I know that even in Hong Kong, NGOs have been spreading very conservative kind of messages. There have been religious right NGOs that have gone into schools to
I think that's the questions about the complexity of civil society. Now, just let me give an illustration to what Dan was saying. 3 years ago, there's a demonstration in Hong Kong on July 1st, and 500,000 people showed up. And at that time, that's the year when Hong Kong was hit by SARS and just economic recessions and all that. So people always refer to that one event as, look at, the triumph of Hong Kong civil society standing up to the government. Now, people and the groups who made up that demonstrations were very interesting because you have gay and lesbians organizations, domestic workers from Indonesia and from the Philippines. You have Christian churches and all that, right? So basically, you have a collection of just everybody from a wide range of political spectrum. Now, and then I think it was last year, there's always, every time since then, they try to have, this march on July 1st every year. Now, but then there's always a debate is which group will lead the demonstration, which group will stand in front of the lead demonstration. Now, there was a controversy last year. The organizer decided to let the gay and lesbian organization to lead the demonstration. Now, then there are like strong oppositions from the Christian churches in Hong Kong.
Yeah,
so what you see is civil society is not one unified whole, everybody with the same ideology. So happened that, on this particular issue, they're all against the state or, the Hong Kong government. But there are a lot of divisions. There are people with groups with different ideologies. Some are more liberal, some are more conservative. Yeah.
And I think we've played on this show before a talk given by a professor at Taiwan, in Taiwan, who's warned against this kind of conservative NGO kind of influence in Taiwan, for instance, on sexual politics, especially with religious right kind of NGOs getting state subsidies or going into schools to talk against homosexuality, that kind of stuff. So So this whole issue about NGOs are not, you know, it's I think it's interesting to see that, to realize that NGOs are not always the liberators.
Yeah, just to show the more, another example of the diversities of the political spectrum, the Catholic Church has always been very critical of globalization. Now, what is interesting about the anti-WTO demonstration when it happened in Hong Kong was the bishop of Hong Kong was highly, highly critical of the Hong Kong police handling of the South Korean demonstrators. Now, it's kind of interesting because, well, this bishop has been politically involved and he's been supporting the quote-unquote democracy movement. Now, but while his more, I guess, the lawyers, you know, the teachers, his more, I guess, fellow Democratic counterparts, they didn't really say anything. They never really talk about WTOs. I mean, the middle class Democrats in Hong Kong, they're basically silent about the WTO, right? Now, but the bishop, unlike them, was very highly critical of the Hong Kong police handling of the demonstrators. So again, it's another example of how you have many, many different divisions among these different groups making up what we call civil society.
So is do you see, what's your opinion of students then over there, in Hong Kong university students in general in Hong Kong? Are they more politically active now than when you were growing up?
Well, okay, now this is now I guess this is how I answer the question. Now, I think it's common to kind of like refer to Hong Kong as a like a economic financial city. People are more concerned with making money, and you know, they don't really care much about politics, blah blah blah. Now, but if you really look at the history of Hong Kong, it has a pretty vibrant revolutionary history. There's a seaman strike, I think, just in 1921, Hong Kong seaman strike against the British. 22. And then 1925, there's also a huge general strike against the colonial government. And the strike in 1925 was actually an example, an event that inspired a lot of international communists led them to think that maybe, you know, we should switch our attention from Europe to Asia. Maybe, you know, the workers in Asia can do something, right? That was after the, you know, failures of revolutions in Germany. Now, then even after 1945, after war's over, after the British took over Hong Kong, retook Hong Kong, there are also a series of demonstrations and movements against the British colonial government. So my point is that there's always been a vibrant history of resistance against colonialism in Hong Kong. Now, but then maybe starting in the 1980s, things kind of took on a different turn, you know. People were concerned with other issues. Now, then to get back to Deng's question. Now, if you look at Hong Kong from a long-term historical trajectory, there's always been that kind of political activism. Although things were quieter in the 80s, right? Now, in the 1990s and in the 21st century, are we seeing a resurgence of that kind of political activity? This is a huge question. I think I'm optimistic about it because of what I was saying earlier. There are also signs of attempts to carve out a third space, alternative politics, and that kind of politics becoming more popular in Hong Kong. So I think there are indications that things are going to be more vibrant. Yeah.
On that point, I guess we're out of time. Thank you very much, Choy Wai Git, who's a student, a graduate student here at UC Irvine in sociology. We've been talking about the anti-WTO protests in Hong Kong and analyzing the events in the context of kind of social movement and political protests. Thank you. Stay tuned for Blues Show coming up. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Check the website for Subversity, kuci.org/DTSANG. And you can find links to some of the resources we talk about. I'll be posting more of that. And eventually we'll be posting the audio, the digital archive of this program. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.